Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Money can be the cause of massive tension in relationships. Do you let it simmer just beneath the surface, or do you address it in the hope that you can come up with a solution to the issue? Psychologist Leanne Davey says you might want to take the risk and talk about it. She is the author of The Good Fight, a book about how to use productive conflict to get back on track. Then, math and money are inextricably linked. If you're not confident with the former, it's going to be pretty hard to get on top of the latter. So we are going to go back to basics with the author of Math Hacks. Vanessa Vicaria will be here to talk about some ideas on how to engage in the magic of math. And we'll talk to Manisha Tokor. She is the host of the True Wealth podcast, a show that explores the different ways people spend their time and money, and the who, what, when, where, why, and how of open banking. It's a phrase you're going to be hearing a lot more about. Justin Farabee is the COO of Payments Canada. Plus, family lawyer Laura Paris on dogs and divorce. I love this topic. I don't love divorce, but I love the question of who gets to keep the pets when a marriage breaks down. All that is ahead. Let's get started. Money is a touchy subject. It can lead to conflict, or maybe more often, conflict avoidance. Sometimes it's just easier not to talk about what's bothering you with your spouse, with your kids, even with your financial advisor. But our next guest argues that conflict is critical. Author, speaker, psychologist Leanne Davey is here to tell us about her new book, The Good Fight. Hello there.
Hello.
You speak to organizations, you consult to organizations. I know that the workplace is your primary audience, but I think your approach is so relevant when it comes to money, which is why I invited you here. What is a good fight?
A good fight is one that you can get to the other side of. How's that? It's one that you can get on the table and work through so that at the other end of it, you're in a better place, your relationships are stronger, and you like to look at yourself in the mirror. All of those things make a good fight.
You say, quote, conflict is a natural part of healthy relationships and a critical defense against unhealthy. What?
Oh, I know. Well, first of all, it's understanding that conflict is a part of the human condition. You know, things like money, raising kids, that's a recipe for conflict. Making decisions at work, at home, doing things in your community soccer team, all of these things create conflict. So conflict is just a given, but it's when we try and avoid conflict that we get to a really unhealthy place. So we can have healthy, happy relationships if we surface those conflicts and get past them. But the other half, that second half about it's a critical defense, I got thinking about this with the Me Too movement. Mm. And how I realized how many kids like me got taught to mind their own business. Mm. So they stayed out of issues that weren't theirs. And the problem is when you're locked in an issue, particularly if you're the victim, it's really hard to get yourself out of it. And it's actually other people who can get into the issue, raise the concern, advocate on your behalf. And they're the ones that can protect us from relationships that are becoming unhealthy. So knowing how to have conflict well does both, makes our good relationships better, but also protects us from those dangerous and unhealthy relationships.
So I talk to people about money all the time, and they whisper their issues, quite often related to the spousal dynamic, and people have different values around money. They have different practices around money. So if we use that sort of as our context, I want you to explain the concept of conflict debt, which is such an appropriate metaphor when talking about money here.
It is, isn't it? Okay, well, I'm sure all of your listeners know about how painful credit card debt can become.
Yes.
So the thing that, oh, I know I need this, I can't really afford it, so I'm going to put it on my card, that old sound we used to make with our credit cards, and then we think we're going to pay it off, but we don't, and we carry a balance, and then the interest compounds, and we can get really underwater with our credit card debt. So the exact same thing is true. We get into a conversation we know we should have. Maybe, you know, we're planning our next vacation and we think our partner's, you know, being a bit too extravagant and we should really talk about it. But it's like, oh, that's going to get into a fight and it's going to be horrible. So we put it on our card. We just leave it. We avoid the issue. But the problem is, then you're going to build up resentment. And maybe you're going to build up actual debt of booking a vacation that was too expensive. But also, you're going to start to resent him or her, right? You're going to be in that situation where you're thinking, oh, that's so irresponsible, and what we could have done if we weren't under that debt. So conflict debt is this pall that we live under when there are issues we haven't resolved. And not only is it the initial issue, but then all of the resentment that builds up around it.
One of the things that I note, I mean, I have a friend who notes this, because I wouldn't ever be in a position where I would ever have any conflict. But I note that sometimes we go into these conversations, even if we're willing to have them, with the deeply held belief that the other is wrong and that we are going to kind of tiptoe around it, find a way to give them feedback, find a way to win them over to our point of view. How do you navigate the right-wrong paradigm when it comes to, for example, should we spend on that vacation or not?
Yeah, so it's a very, very hard thing to accept. But first of all, particularly when we're talking about relationships, right? This is somebody you're hopefully going to be living with for the rest of your life. So whether one of you is right or wrong is really the least important question.
Right.
Is do we get to a point that's workable and that we can both feel comfortable with? So the concept I like to talk about is that there are often two truths. So in the vacation example, we need to be careful with our money. We need to make prudent choices. We need to make sure we keep our emergency slush fund where we need it. That's true. At the same time, we need to enjoy our money, and we need to have experiences together that allow us to enjoy the present. And if we can get to the point of understanding that most of our fights are not about who's right and who's wrong, it's about how do we come to the best answer when both of these things are true.
You have a 3C solution. Establish a line of communication, create a connection, contribute to a solution. Let's go to your vacation example. Just briefly, what are those 3 C's look like? What do they sound like in that discussion?
Yeah, so the establish a line of communication is find a time and a place where you're willing to broach the subject. And ideally, when that's in the future. So you might say, hey, I know it's getting to be time when we book our Christmas vacation. I'd love to actually talk a little bit before we book it about, you know, what we think is right to do. So introduce the topic. And as you broach the subject, do it with openness. Do it with language that says, let's come to a good answer. So what you don't want to say is, you know, you are so stingy about our vacation every year. That's not a good way to start. But you might want to start with, you know, I'd love to have a conversation about how much we want to save and how much we want to enjoy ourselves. You broach it like that. And then listen. So this is how you establish this line of communication. Find a time, broach the subject as an open two-way dialogue, and then listen hard for what you get in return.
I want to ask about this contribute to a solution part. That's the third piece of it. What could that look like in the aside from just do it my way? That's the solution.
So let's go back to the two truths idea. So if you've done that, one of the ways to contribute to a solution is say, okay, I hear you. We need to be careful about making sure our slush fund is at a healthy 6-month level. And I'm glad that you understand that, you know, I want to enjoy being with you. All right. So where's a place that would, you know, maybe give us an opulent experience at not an opulent price? Or maybe is there a chance where we actually have a shorter vacation at a really nice place that, you know, works for us in terms of our budget? So it's saying your point is true, my point is true. Now let's problem solve together about what are our options. And I think we get locked in these boxes, like we always go on a 7-day vacation. What if we went on a 4-day to somewhere really awesome, et cetera, et cetera. So then we can find solutions.
Ideally, the good fight leads to a new state, but sometimes it doesn't. The good fight becomes a bad fight in a horrible circumstance. What are the signs that you might need to break up with your spouse? You might need to break up with your financial advisor or over something. This doesn't work 1,000% of the time.
Yeah, it absolutely doesn't. And so it's really understanding that at some level, your values are so different from one another. So financial advisor is a great one. You may have a financial advisor who has this plan to make you filthy rich when you're 65, but it's requiring too many compromises at this stage. And you're somebody who believes that, you know, it's as much about balancing your experience over the next 30 years as it is having some great reward at the end. And when you get to that point of understanding that in a partner, in a financial advisor, pretty much anybody other than your kids who you can't break up with. With anybody else, you know, there's the chance to say, you know, we've really worked to understand each other. I really understand where you're coming from now. And I really am not comfortable with it. It doesn't suit me. It's not how I want to live my life. And if it's at that values level, those are legitimate reasons to go separate ways. I think the problem is we seldom get to those values, and we just kind of break up with fighting over, you know, which vacation we want to take when we didn't do the work to say, let's understand what's underneath.
We've just got 30 seconds left, but I do want to ask you, what is the conflict habit? Does that mean I get all yelly and I'm just yelly like all the time?
Yelly's bad.
No yelly?
No yelling. Well, not no yelling, but when you yell, they come back and go, hey, that's not how I wanted to handle that
situation. Right.
So if you yell, that's okay. Don't worry. But the conflict habit is having smaller, lower impact conflicts more frequently. So do the hard thing more frequently, which means we don't have to get into these really ugly, yelly conflicts, you know, later.
The Good Fight is the name of the book. It's author Leanne Davey. Thank you for joining us today, Leanne. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Her focus is on organizations and teams, but I snuck her in because I knew she'd have something smart to say about personal finance.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Math isn't everyone's favorite subject. Is that the understatement of the year? No, it's true. Whoever thought that high school was the last time you'd need to do anything math related was completely wrong. Managing your money involves some math. It absolutely involves some math. And many adults aren't comfortable with math, and that can affect their ability to get a handle on their money. Vanessa Vicaria is the author of a book called Math Hacks. It is aimed at kids, but I think it applies to parents too. Hello, Vanessa.
Hello.
I saw your book and I grabbed onto it for two reasons. Number one, I have a 9-year-old. It's perfect for her. Mm-hmm. But number two, it was a great way for me to start talking about the math part of personal finance because I never talk about it. We never talk about it. So tell me about why you think people, adults, are so uncomfortable with math.
So there are honestly so many reasons, but I really think one of the main reasons is literally like we make it okay to be freaked out about math.
Oh, okay.
Like, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
No,
boo, I'm sorry you have a hard time with math.
Right?
That.
Or it's like people are like, oh my God, like can't even balance a checkbook. And people are like, oh my God, me neither. Like, you know what I mean? It's like this culturally
get a hold of yourself.
Thing.
You're an adult.
Yeah, exactly.
Balance your checkbook.
Exactly. And we just, it's a socially acceptable thing. And then also like tied into that is I really think most adults I've spoken to have had like a traumatic experience with math.
Now, this was not always an area of confidence for you. You say at the beginning of your book, you failed grade 11 math, what, twice?
Two times.
And now you have a master's in math education.
Mm-hmm.
So that is just, I mean, I can't even. What was life like before the skies parted and the birds sang?
Okay, so I actually think this is a really important point to your first question, which, you know, we're like, oh my God, why do people have such a hard time with math? We are taught that math is something that is an innate ability. So like how many people do you know that are like, oh, I'm just not a math person?
Right.
So I thought I just wasn't a math person because I just wanted to like be in a rock band and marry Keanu Reeves.
Yes.
Still do, whatever.
Yes.
So this idea when I wasn't performing well at math, my teachers and peers were like, well, yeah, you're more the creative type. You're not a math person. Now, my parents were like, yeah, that's really cool that you want to move to LA, but you need to graduate high school. So they sent me to an alternative school. And at this school, where I ended up getting a 99 in grade 12 math, when I told my math teacher I wasn't a math person, her response was, that's not a thing. You know, like, and that needs to be our response.
Right.
It's like, I had this feeling that I was innately incapable of something. And I think that's how most adults feel about math. They either have it or they don't. and they don't have it and they're never going to have it. Right. And that's the end of it.
I was good at math, but I was not good at grade 10 calculus. And I remember where I was sitting in the classroom at Oak Ridge Secondary School in London, Ontario, when Mr. Brown came over to me and like moved my pencil 3/4 of an inch. And I went, and it all clicked and I got in Queen's Commerce and I like I was able to excel. How do we help provide a catalyst for adults to have them click into math?
Okay, so I really think the first thing is getting over that psychological barrier to really stop believing the myth that there is such a thing as somebody who can do math and someone who can't. That's just simply not a thing. So I think that's the first step. And honestly, the reason I wrote this book is because so many adults who are uncomfortable with numbers, it's something they got stuck on when they were younger. Like they just couldn't get past fractions or like there was that traumatic moment in long division. So I encourage adults to actually pick a concept that gave them nightmares in grade school and learn it.
Go back and learn it.
Learn it. Learn one thing to prove to yourself that you can. And I think that is when you have that like aha moment of being like, oh my gosh, like this is actually so much easier than I thought it was. And if I can do that, what else can I do?
Your book is a delightful extension of the personality that you're demonstrating in our studio here. Tell me what that first meeting is with a student who comes to the math guru to learn. How much of that is the multiplication tables and how much of you is that you being you and engaging with them as a human being?
So like I would say 80-20 focused on the latter. So because really it's so many students aren't ready to learn math yet. You have to be ready to accept the fact that you can learn math before you start learning math. So a lot of the first approach is just being like, tell me why you're bad at math and getting them to really dig deep to realize there's no factual reason, you know, that. And then teaching a few little tips and tricks, like I like to call them the party tricks, the kind of like open kids.
What's an example of a party trick?
Oh my God. Okay. My favorite party trick is multiplying anything by five. So so to do that, you just add a zero and divide by two.
You add a zero and divide by two.
So you can do like crazy things.
Okay. Okay.
Don't give me one on the spot. I really hate doing math on the spot. I get anxious.
No, I was doing it on the spot for myself.
Like do like 33 times 5 really quick. Okay, so it's 330 divided by 2.
Which is 150 plus 15, 165? I think that's right. Let's just say it's right. Listeners can text us later if it's not right.
Like, oh my God. Yeah, 165. That's it. Yeah. 165. But do you see what I mean? Like something like that where all of a sudden that's so cool and it's really not that hard. And it has not much to do with actual math, but it does.
Right.
Like, just opening.
I'm now a savant. I am Rain Man.
Right. From you can go to parties and be like, anything multiplied by five, and people are like, what?
And then someone will be like, could I multiply something by six? No.
You're like, that's not what we're doing right now.
That's not the game we're playing. So, one of the most important concepts in personal finance is compound interest. It is like my, my holy grail. Yeah. It is my, I love. What would you say to someone about that as a concept that might be able to help them grasp it? Because I feel if everybody grasped it, they would behave in such a different way.
Such a different way. Okay. So first of all, compound interest is based on percentages.
Yes.
Right? Like the entire thing is based on percentages and the idea of like, which is one of the topics that people really, really struggle with. So I mean, what do you say? I think you really need to go back, actually, literally teach somebody about percentages, show them how easy it is, and then you get into compound interest. Really, compound interest is a pretty simple concept, right?
Yeah.
The idea that you make. Why are people? I'm actually very curious.
They've
what
just
the
never
is.
They've been never able to make it. It's not the calculation because you can use a computer
so
to do the calculation.
It?
They can't see that the ability to save $100 now will be worth
so
$30 bazillion dollars in retirement.
I honestly feel the best way because we teach compound interest in grade 11.
Right.
So I think the best actual thing to do is just show examples. Like I always show kids examples. I'm like, do a calculation of $50 now, and then in 20 years do the same $50 up till you're 80, and they're like, oh my God.
Oh my God.
And then you explain to them why that works. It makes sense.
So tell me about some coping strategies that parents might be able to take on for themselves because they have to work with their kids on math. Their kid brings home the math and they're like, can you help me with my homework? And they freeze and crack open a bottle of Chianti because that's the only way they're going to be able to survive.
Mm-hmm. Not a bad coping mechanism.
As a matter of fact.
So I think something for parents to realize is how I hate to say this, but like how much pressure kids are really, really under right now. So much of that anxiety around math has to do with comparing themselves to other people, and to like really even kids in as young as grade two are thinking about marks in university. So to really break that down. And honestly, my favorite thing, and this is what I emphasize in the book, is to really teach your kids how to fail and have a good time at it. So like math is all about inquiry. It's all about trying stuff. It's all about failing and learning from that. And we as parents and teachers and educators and just people should be encouraging failure in mathematics. That is the number one learning tool.
So we should talk about my 28% in microeconomics in first year university. Is that helpful to the world?
I think so.
Yeah. We all know I did terrible in microeconomics.
I think so. I think that's something you probably learned from.
Yeah, I did. And then I aced macro
the next semester. There you go. I think failure is one of the things we really take out of math class, and it needs to be put back in. Like, kids are so terrified of math because it's one of those subjects that has a right and a wrong. And we are taught in school, which is horrible, that we shouldn't fail. And that's not true, right? So when you get to a subject that seems so black and white, they're so scared of getting something wrong, they don't try. So I think that's really the big thing.
Have you thought of cloning yourself? Barbara Streisand cloned her dog. So if you just cloned yourself. Yeah, she totally did. $75,000. So clone yourself and put yourself in schools and you just hang out. Vanessa, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Vanessa Vaccari is the author of a book called Math Hacks. You will just love it. It is exactly how she sounds in our conversation. It's great for kids. It's great for you. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, Manisha Thakur will be here to talk about the new True Wealth podcast. And later, all you need to know about open banking, which I can't even tell you. I don't know that I want to know anything about open banking, but our next guest promises to make it interesting. He is Justin Farabee. He is the COO of Payments Canada. I almost wanted to say sommelier, but that's not it. COO of Payments Canada. And if you want to get a new episode of Moolala downloaded straight to your device every week, make sure you subscribe. Write us a review, too. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
People define success in so many different ways. Yeah, for some, it's about having lots of money. Sure, for others, it's about success as a parent or a spouse or making a difference in the community or in the world. What is true wealth? Manisha Thakur is the Vice President of Financial Education at wealth management firm Brighton Jones. She has just launched a podcast called True Wealth, spelled W-E-L-L-T-H. So classy and creative. It's all about helping people align the way they spend their money and their time with what matters most to them in life. Manisha, hello there.
Bruce, hello. It's great to hear your voice.
Tell us about this podcast. What are you trying to do that has not already been done?
I'm trying to answer the question of how you align the way you spend your money and time through the lens of two key questions. And the first one is, what if success, as traditionally defined by modern society, is nothing more than a recipe for disconnection from yourself, from others, from life, from community itself? And the second is, what if everything we've been taught about money and, quote, making it literally and figuratively is just plain wrong? And so through exploration with experts in the four core areas of well-being, emotional, social, physical, financial, I'm exploring these questions.
I listened to the episode with Jonathan Fields, an entrepreneur and big thinker in the U.S. You've also had Gene Chatsky, Carol Richards. How do you determine who is a good fit for the show?
Yeah, it's interesting. I need two things. Number one is the ability for someone to go really deep with me. I want to hear their story, not at the surface level, but at the emotional level. And then the second is that they're able to provide a framework or some new ideas that can help listeners make those tiny tweaks or radical reboots that help them realign the way they're spending their money and their time with what matters most. And so experts come in a wide, or guests come in a wide range of formats. Some are academic, some are in the corporate world, some are in the nonprofit world. But they're all people with expertise in one of the four core areas, sharing their insights in the format of their own stories, which is what makes it so interesting. And all episodes are less than 30 minutes. We aim for 25 because the average commute time in the U.S. is 26 minutes, and the average meal prep time is 31 minutes. So we want you to be able to digest the whole episode in one of those two ways, if you'd like.
Right. You interviewed Vicki Robin, co-author of Your Money or Your Life, which is a classic in the personal finance space. What did you take away from that conversation in particular?
Oh, my God. So the biggest thing that I took away from Vicki is that because we no longer live in what she calls place-based living, meaning that we are in a community that we will be in for the bulk of our lives. For instance, you know, 100 years ago, it was rare that you might go more than 10, 15 miles in your whole life away from where you live. And as a result, as she can say, you can foul, mess up your nest, and then move on to the next place without any real repercussions. And she says this lack of human connectivity and long-term repercussions for behavior that's not in the best interest of the community is putting at risk, putting us all at risk for literally civilizational survival. And so her message of Your Money or Your Life, the classic book that came out in 1992 and was re-released in 2018, she's now taking even deeper from just simply the money part to literally the life part, and she's defining that on a global community-wise basis.
Wow. Now, the idea of contentment has come up on a number of your episodes, and the argument that we aren't wired for contentment. What does that mean?
Yeah, so I have had several behavioral psychologists on who focus in finance or in the areas of productivity and organizational behavior. And in both cases, what they found is that there's just something about the human mind that is programmed to never be satisfied with enough. And we even had the former CEO, current chairman of Juniper Networks, enormously successful, kind man, Scott Krenz, who started a big thinking wellness retreat called 1440 Multiversity. Even he came on and said, you know, from a practitioner standpoint, running a global multinational, he's experienced this, and that the solution to this kind of constant seeking is increased connection with the people in our lives right now, the causes in our lives right now, and going through a level of self-inquiry to understand who you really are and what environments you thrive in. That's how you arrive at contentment. It's not looking outward, it's looking inward and then forming human bonds.
My guest is Manisha Thakur. She is the host of a podcast called True Wealth, W-E-L-L-T-H. Manisha, you have been in finance like your whole career. You graduated from the Harvard Business School. You had a very traditional start in the industry. What was your light bulb? What had you connect the dots in a way that was different from your classmates who are still working at Goldman Sachs on Wall Street?
Yeah, so I've been in finance for 25 years, and what clicked for me were two things. I face-planted in life in two very distinct directions. One, my marriage collapsed. I'm 49, and it happened out of the blue as a result of extreme workaholism on my part and, honestly, neglect of my now ex-husband, who we have a very kind platonic relationship now, but I mean, I treated him horribly because I constantly put the quest for W-E-A-L-T-H ahead of W-E-L-L-T-H. And then also because I was working so hard, Bruce, I always struggled with deep depression and anxiety. But I just thought, well, you know, that's just the way it is. My general physician had prescribed me Prozac back when I was in business school, and I thought, well, that's that. Turns out I'm bipolar, which only was caught 2 years ago, because when I am in hypomania, most people who have bipolar do things like really destructive behavior, binge drinking, and spending wantonly. And I go into extreme workaholism, which in finance is called being a good employee.
Right.
So it wasn't caught. And those two things just made me realize that the quest for WEALTH has resulted for me personally in a very empty, lonely life. I'm divorced, single, childless. Got plenty of WEALTH, and I wanted to fix this issue in my own life and help other people who might be struggling in these same ways to solve it in their own lives.
Is there one dream guest that you have in your mind that we should just put out to the universe that they will hear about this and dial in? Whose wisdom would you, or whose brain would you love to pick on your chosen topic?
Hands down, Michelle Obama.
Michelle Obama. Why?
Because she has just, I mean, she first of all, she's so incredibly bright, Harvard trained lawyer. She's seen, she's had a range of careers on her own part. She's seen and observed the height of power that most of us can never even imagine. And yet she's had a fulfilling life as a mother and a wife and a daughter. And she's just so full of wisdom, and I think what she can teach us, even beyond the amazing book she wrote, Becoming, would be fascinating on this topic.
Michelle, if you're listening, Manisha Tekwar's podcast is called True Wealth, WEALTH.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you so much for joining us. We love you, Michelle. Thank you for joining us, and best of luck with the podcast, Manisha. Take care.
Bye, Bruce. Thank you.
True Wealth is available on podcast platforms such as iTunes. Find it, listen to it, subscribe to it. It's very simple. Stay with us. Coming up next on the show, who gets to keep the family pet in a divorce? Laura Paris from Shulman Law is here to tell us how divorcing couples can navigate this process without fighting like cats and dogs. And Leanne Davey is back for How I Do It. We'll ask her how she manages her money. If you don't want to miss an episode of Moolah La, you can subscribe to this show on any of the podcast platforms. And while you're there, give us a review. You can also check out a big episode or archive of past episodes at moolahla.ca. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
A lot of people consider their beloved little pet a part of their family. So for divorcing couples, fighting over who gets to keep their furry little friend can be just as emotional and expensive as fighting over custody of the children. According to our next guest, changes to the laws in Canada might be coming. Family lawyer Laura Paris joins us to talk about dogs and divorce. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
Not just dogs. Probably you've seen everything. Hamsters, geckos, snakes,
of course, all of it.
You believe it is important for couples to consider pets in a separation agreement. That makes sense. But why is it so important?
Well, the thing is, when we're looking at what the law is in Canada, or the current state of the law in Canada, is that pets are treated as property. So the cheapest way to deal with a dispute that may be, arising over a pet is to try and deal with it in an amicable fashion through negotiations rather than seeking intervention of the court.
When you say property, is it like valued on a spreadsheet? Like the flat screen TV?
I mean, technically speaking, yeah, that's how you deal with property, which is why these pets are not, they don't really fall into any category very cleanly. How do you value a pet? Is it based on what you purchased it for, or is it based on what you believe it's worth?
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
We'll talk about the courts in a second, but when couples are at their best and they are amicable and they've found a way to make it work, what are some solutions that they come up with when it comes to pets? Is it pet travels with the children? Pet has its own custody arrangement. Pet stays at one home. The other has access. Like, what are some ways that they do it?
Something that is common when you do have children is that the pet is traveling with the children if there is a more or less equal splitting of childcare arrangement. So if you have a 50-50 schedule, it is common that you'll see that the pet is traveling with the kids. When you're dealing with a situation where one parent has primary care over a child, then usually that parent will keep the family dog, being that it's in the child's best interest that they not be taken away from their family pet. So that's one way you can look at it. When you don't have children in the mix, you may be looking at it just strictly from we are dealing with the custody of this dog. We have two individuals who both want to spend time with this dog. How do we deal with it? You can fashion that in any way you want, whatever way makes sense
for
you.
If couples are unable to be amicable and they go nuclear, what do the courts most often say? Are there precedents? What's the starting point for how a judge might rule?
Get this out of my court.
Get this out of my court. I'm not talking about
a
dog.
Yeah, that's probably the first thing they want to say, whether or not they say it. But the way that it's treated is it is treated as property. So you're looking at who is the owner of this property. Is someone able to prove that they were the one that put up the funds to purchase? That's going to be the starting point of dealing with any sort of asset. One party may have ownership interest in the particular asset. The other party has a beneficial interest.
So you have more rights if, for example, you had the dog yourself before you were married, then you get married, and then the dog is shared for
Absolutely.
All intents and purposes.
Yes.
You brought it into the marriage.
Yes. Yep.
In the U.S., there are some new concepts. Pet trusts is one of them. Tell us what that is. How does it work?
So essentially, a pet trust is something that is put into place when you are dealing with a shared custody arrangement of a pet. And it is almost like a shared bank account that you deposit money into. Each party deposits a certain sum of money into that you draw from for pet-related expenses, food, vet bills, etc.
Do people include pets in prenuptial agreements?
It's not to say that it's the most often thing that you come across. A lot of people don't turn their mind to their pets when they're thinking of what they're protecting when they're going into a marriage. But it certainly is something that you can include, and it probably makes sense to include it.
What are the sort of costs that are involved in a separation and exacerbated by conflicts over the arrangements with a pet?
Well, there are some circumstances where you have spouses fighting over pets out of spite, not because they actually are interested in keeping that pet, but because they know that the other party is very interested in it. So they're just making an argument over it just to drive up costs. So that's in those circumstances where you're doing something out of spite. You certainly see that the costs really, really spiking in those circumstances. And I mean, generally speaking, if you aren't able to come to an amicable agreement on how to deal with the pet, it's going to get costly because the law is not settled on it. So even if when you do go to seek the court intervention of it, they don't even have a perfect remedy for dealing with this situation.
Pets aren't free. They cost money for food and toys and vet care and all that stuff, as do kids. Now, there is a framework for child support and spousal support and all that stuff. Is there a framework for how money goes back and forth when it comes to pet care?
There isn't. And I feel like that's actually one of the things that's probably stopping Canada from, reforming their laws on this, because you're opening a pretty big floodgate when you're starting to consider pets in the same context of how you're considering children and custody and support of them.
So when you do intake with a client that you are going to represent in a divorce and they say, listen, I've got this pet, what advice do you have for them in terms of how to think about it?
So if someone is coming to me before they're actually dealing with a separation, if it's in the context of a marriage or getting into a marriage,
you say, ship the dog to Mexico. Yeah. Hide that dog. Take them across the border.
Yes, that, or turn your mind to getting an agreement together now, starting to think through, who will take the dog in the circumstance of a separation, who's going to be responsible for the cost, what vet you're going to go to, and if you're going to stay with that vet, who's going to make important decisions on the the dog's behalf. That's if you're dealing with it beforehand. If after the fact, I mean, the first thing I would say is try to deal with it amongst yourselves. Those are definitely questions you need to figure out in terms of who's caring for it, who's making decisions for it, who's paying for it. Those are all things, obviously, that need to be figured out. But main advice is try to figure it out amongst yourselves, because if you got to go to court, it's going to be treated as property. And I think that, you know, no one really likes to look at it in that way.
Just in the 30 seconds before we go, are there cases in which pets have really blown up? Are there, you know, celebrities or stories or legal precedents that have been made in the case of pet custody? Because I can imagine it's more common than we would think.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that that we see it necessarily in our Canadian press, but
we're
definitely
so much more polite.
See it in Hollywood. There's a recent case actually involving Mandy Moore, and it's in relation to the new reform laws, the pet reform laws in California, which are now giving this special status to pets. It's still considering them as property, but it's also giving the judges an ability to look at them from a bit of a different angle and recognize their unique status. So, for sure.
So many things to think about, Laura. Thank you very much for your time. Our conversation was about pets and divorce and something you really need to think about. Laura Paris is with Shulman Family Law. Well, stay with us. Coming up next, Justin Farabee, the COO of Payments Canada. He'll be here to talk about the benefits and some of the risks associated with open banking and how I do it. We'll ask Leanne Davey about how she manages her money. Like what you hear on the show so far or not, you hate every single word? Well, let me know. Our email address is ask@moolala.ca. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Open banking. You are going to hear this phrase more and more in the years ahead, and it has nothing to do with the hours of your local branch. So what is open banking, and what does it mean for you as an individual? Justin Farabee is the COO of Payments Canada. He's here to talk about what you need to know about open banking. Hello there.
Hi.
So what is it? This is the jargon du jour. We should probably be well-versed. Your definition may be no longer than 5 words.
Ooh, I got 9.
9.
I got 9
I'll
words.
I'll take 9.
Okay.
I'll take
mandatory
9.
Use of standard interfaces for banking information and payments. Now, hold on.
That is the most boring 9 words I've ever heard in my life.
It is, but you got to bear with me. It's
okay.
A big deal.
All right.
It's important. It's worth it.
Okay,
stick
I'm ready.
With it. It's worth
I'm staying.
It. Mandatory means all the banks have to do it.
All the banks have to do something.
You're going to have to do something. Standard means only one way to do it across everybody.
Uh-huh.
And it's for banking information and to make payments.
What is the benefit to a consumer of that very long and very boring 9-word definition?
I know. It seems
yeah.
really
Aren't
boring.
Aren't you in charge of this? Can't you rebrand it? You need a better PR firm.
We should. We totally do. The big thing that's important to consumers is it takes the control of your financial information from your financial institution and puts it in your hands. So you start to control your information and you're able to use the information more effectively, get more services for it.
Who is pushing this? Because I can't imagine that it would be the banks, given that they love to have a certain level of control on the information their clients.
But banks are a trusted party and an important party, and they're open to this as well. They believe in it. They subscribe to it. They want to move in a paced way to make sure it's safe and secure, but they're supportive of it. We've seen it implemented in other countries, and it's very effective.
But who's pushing it?
Oh,
Where does
pushing
it start?
It right now, this starts with consumer groups, with new fintech or paytech companies that are trying to develop
lobbying
new
the
services.
Government to say we need to make this happen?
Yes.
What's Payments Canada's role?
Payments Canada is a payments infrastructure, so we process all the payments that happen in the economy every day. We clear and settle them. Our position is not to advocate for open banking or not to. We have a position on it based on our understanding of it, and we think that it's good for the Canadian market, but we're not the champions of it.
So Bruce now has control over my data. What does that mean for me in practical terms?
You get a complete view of all of your financial information. You may have information in different places. You may have a credit card. You may have a line of credit. You may have your investments in different places, different bank accounts, current accounts. Maybe you have a small business. You got information everywhere. What it allows you to do is bring it all together in one place. You can do that now. You have paper statements. You bring them in. You can pull all that together. You can sit down with a financial advisor. You can lay them all out. And,
yep. And there are some fintechs who scrape your different accounts.
That's
and
right.
Can aggregate it.
And so the screen scraping is actually what open banking is intended to perform the same functions as that, but screen scraping isn't safe. So you're providing your credentials. You could be violating your account agreement, which terminates your protection that you get. So the screen scraping is actually bad behavior that open banking is trying to mitigate and trying to introduce in a safe way.
What is the way to make open baking? I love baking. So we could bake anything. Cookies? No. Different topic. What is a way to make open banking safe? How do you make it safe?
That's exactly the concern, is about cybersecurity and privacy and all of those things. So the first thing is that you need to control the cybersecurity pieces. You have to ensure that the standard protocols allow it to be very focused, very controlled, and very safe. We have moved from branch banking to online banking, from online banking to mobile banking. We can move to open banking. We can do it in a safe way, but it must be done in a safe way.
There will obviously be a pretty significant IT spend mm-hmm. for governments, for banks, for whomever. Who will bear the cost of that?
At the end of the day, it'll likely be the shareholder of the banks.
How much of an infrastructure spend is this? For countries that are ahead of us, is this like 10% of GDP, or is it in the modest millions?
It's in the modest millions. It's actually almost fractional. You wouldn't notice it. The cost, I say, almost tongue-in-cheek, the shareholders of the banks, but it's minuscule. It wouldn't be noticed because
right.
this is material. The technologies that are being used are not new technologies. They're being used in other ways. They would just be used for this purpose.
For the countries that are ahead of us on this, what are the benefits? What have they been talking about that said, this is worth it. This change was worth it. The education effort was worth it. It was worth it. Why?
The biggest thing is competition for financial services. So you're going to be better matched to the services you need. If I can see all of how you're using your bank account and I can see the way you're using it, I can find the best bank account for you, the best investment for you, or any financial product can be competed because I can see visibility. So by allowing that information to be accessed, a fintech can come in, they can pull it all together, they can look at it, and they can prepare good options for you that are much more accurate to what you have. They're in real time and they can match you up. So imagine a loyalty program. Maybe use Aeroplan or whatever program you use. If you're able to see your actual payments and see where you're spending your money and how you would use it, you could probably match yourselves up to a better loyalty program, as an example.
What I don't understand is why a bank or a credit card company would want to do this for profit-seeking corporations. The inefficiencies on pricing dynamics are in their favor, right? So one of the things that has changed in the financial planning world is CRM2. There's much more visibility around advice, but that isn't necessarily helpful if you're running a financial advisory practice, because consumers then stick their heads up and go, what? I'm paying that? This is crazy. So we will see that kind of discontinuity in the marketplace. Why would a bank want that?
You will see the discontinuity. It's a bell curve. There are some who see opportunity. In most cases, we see more opportunity is created because it opens up the market. Right now, people are locked into their financial institutions, and our banks compete fiercely. So they want to gain those customers, they want to gain the advantage, and they want to do it by providing better service. Those who see it move on it, and then those that are behind
will wither and die.
or they catch up.
What are some of the risks or downsides or even issues to mitigate? So I'm sure in all of this, there's so many things. We've talked about data security. What else?
Privacy is the thing most people worry about. And the name is so unfortunate. Open banking implies that it's wide open and your information's all out there.
It's like an open marriage. Like yeah. Ashley Madison is going to be running the entire process.
Just search my name. You can see all my financial information. So it's not that. It's actually the opposite. It's a controlled release of information in a controlled manner that you control. So you can say who sees it when. You have more control over it now than you would otherwise. So for example, if I have my financials, my statement, I can take that to a lender and I can say, here's my statement. They can see everything, but I don't redact it. Whereas with open banking, you can allow access at any point for any amount to whomever you want, and you can retract it as well. So open banking comes with standards, but it's also standards for information and access and your right as a consumer. So your consumer rights come with it.
There is so much that banks and credit card companies could do currently. They're fully enabled. They have all the data and they don't do it. For example, spending by category on your credit card and looking at longer term trends of spending within those categories. The credit card companies have all the data to talk to anybody else to get that data. And yet they still are unable or unwilling to serve it up to me in the way that I want as a consumer. Not all credit card companies, but my credit card company won't do it.
Mine too.
Why is that? I do not understand it. There's a clear and compelling consumer benefit. It would be great for optics, and they don't do it. Tell me why.
Well, there's a multiple part answer to that. One is, in some cases,
Is it as boring as your definition of opening banking?
Yes,
okay.
Yeah. They're right. Not allowed to. Good. In some cases, okay. And they don't want to in other cases.
Why don't they want to?
Well, there's deals they have with how they sell, and they control the information and where it goes, and so there's some restrictions that are put onto it. And there are also some cases where they don't have material amount of information. It looks like they do, but there's not a lot behind it.
What does that mean? I've been with the same credit card company forever. They have every single transaction that I put on that card. Why can't they tell me how much I spent on gas in 2018?
They can on some categories like gas by virtue of it being a gas station, but they don't have the data on what you bought. It's to, from, and maybe what institution or what company you bought it from, but it doesn't have rich data. It doesn't have your receipt data or any of that kind of stuff. So what's coming in the future is more data with payments, which would allow you to do much more analysis and see more stuff in your...
Don't worry, I won't subject you to all my pet peeves. Only a few. Tell me, just before we go here, what expectations should we manage in terms of timing? When is open banking a thing that is alive, real, and in the zeitgeist?
Years.
5 years? 10 years?
3 years. It starts to see 3 years.
So still
within
long
5 years.
Before I have to start coloring my
hair. Yeah, long before that.
Okay, okay. Yeah. So 3 years, and who is the country that is the furthest ahead on
this? The UK.
The UK, so we watch the UK, and maybe
almost say like Europe. Europe is far ahead. The UK is far ahead. Let's imagine that the clock struck 12, and they're already in open banking. In the US, it's coming 10 minutes to 12. We're almost there. In Canada, we're probably about 10:30.
Justin Farabee is the COO of Payments Canada. Our topic, open banking. He may well come a much better definition to lead with than that crummy one. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
One of the ways we can improve how we all behave when it comes to money is to talk about it, which is why we started this next segment. It is called How I Do It, and we ask a series of pretty basic questions about how our guests manage their own personal finances. As I have said before, I would not ask any question that I would not answer myself. Our guest today, Leanne Davey, author of The Good Fight, Using Productive Conflict to Get Your Team and Your Organization Back on Track. Leanne, just the first thing that comes to your mind, okay?
Okay.
You buy money at a coffee shop. Do you pay with cash, debit, or credit?
Debit.
Why?
It's habit for me.
What moved the habit from cash to debit?
Never having cash. I think having teenagers who like poach my wallet, and then all of a sudden I'm somewhere and I don't have any cash left.
Do you mean your teenagers go into your wallet and take money?
It has happened.
It has happened once or twice before. Are your teenagers not on allowance?
They are, and it's possible that my 13-year-old has locked her debit card in a secret drawer and lost the key.
Right. So sometimes your wallet is the backup plan.
Yeah, the bank of mom and dad. Isn't that how it always works?
No, actually, okay. That is not always how it works. Uh-huh. Abby's like, are you telling me I have to pay rent if I want to live in the house after I graduate from post-secondary? I'm like, yeah.
Okay,
she wants to know how much it is.
One.
Yeah,
we're
yeah.
We're clear on that one. Yeah, we're agreed.
What about your financial life is automated?
What about my financial life? So the company's in really good shape, so our Visa bills get paid automatically. All my bill payment is automatic, which is really great for me. What else is automated? I get some good new reminders of things, like a low balance and things like that. I like that a lot. So all those things are automated.
You used to have a job, right, before you started your company. You have made the leap to becoming to being an entrepreneur. How did that affect how you handled your money?
Cash flow was something I understood as a leader in the company as something the CFO would harp on me about, but it was never my problem. So now I understand that just because I've done a whole bunch of work and sent out a bunch of invoices, that cash flow does not equal revenue or invoicing. And that was a really painful lesson. And so sometimes having to think more carefully about when money's coming in and out. And so I think that's translated also into my personal, because of course the bank accounts are connected.
Yeah.
If I'm going to have heavy expenses at a given period, or more importantly, we take the entire month of August off. So now I have to think about, okay, I'm going to have no income in August. How do I manage that? So I'm becoming more aware of that cash flow idea.
You work with your husband.
Yeah, I do.
Which is admirable in and of itself. What is easy for you in that work dynamic around money, and what is hard?
oh, he's the easiest person in the world. I guess the main thing is he's not really interested and has never been interested or motivated in money. So what's easy about that is, you know, he's just a happy guy and could get by with very, very little. He has his guitar and his bike, and that's what he needs. But what's hard about that is then I'm the one, I think, who is thinking about the money and thinking about cash flow. And so I carry some of the worry. But it's really my worry because he doesn't share it.
Who manages your investments? Do you have a financial advisor? Do you have a robo-advisor? You have a financial advisor.
A real human.
A human being.
A human.
And what is something that they do that is helpful to you and your family?
Less than they should be for what I'm paying.
Ah, so this is a service that you might want to optimize.
That is a yes.
That was a very wordy saying,
yes,
wordy way to say it. What would the ideal financial advisor, what services would they provide?
That's a great question. I'm one of those people who doesn't know what I don't know. So because I don't think I've ever really had, so, you know, I get a little bit. So things like, you know, how do you get the RESP stuff going for the kids in college? That they did provide, and that was really useful. You know, they have the standard conversations about helping you think about your risk appetite and you know, those kinds of things and how your investments should shift over time. So I get a little bit of that. I think the problem is, the reason I probably haven't got my butt in gear to change is that I don't really know what else is out there, what I should be expecting or demanding. And so I just go along with the status quo, which probably if you and I had a drink and I'd learn all the ways, that's completely insufficient.
You just go to the library and get my first book. I think it's chapter 6. It will tell you everything you could be asking of your financial advisor. And there are great ones out there. There are great ones out there. Okay, just before we go here, best financial move, worst financial move.
Best financial move was quitting my job. It has been much more lucrative to be out on my own. So that's been a really, really good move. Worst financial move. Having children, of course. That's a terrible financial move. Terrible.
Yeah, but they provide periodic joy, at least, you know, once a week.
They do. So maybe I'll be more specific. Letting my kids get into competitive dancing.
Terrible idea.
Bad financial move. But again, you know, I'm somebody who, you know, some things that are bad financial moves are good life moves. And kids is probably number one on that list.
What is one fight you recall having around money? It could be with Craig, your husband. It could be with your parents growing up, even though I know you lived in a conflict-averse household.
I did. I really did. My parents didn't believe in debt. And when I say they didn't believe in debt, it's not like they didn't believe in it like the tooth fairy. But but my dad was an accountant and an entrepreneur for much of his life. And the reason we had a very comfortable life is they just didn't get into debt. They had two mortgages. And that was the only thing they ever believed into getting into debt for. And so I was a graduate student. I was in university for 10 years. And so there needed to be a little bit of debt. But you didn't really want to talk about that with dad because dad was not,
right.
He was not big on debt at all. So that was one that really, and it's good. It stuck with me. And I use debt intelligently now based on how much money I make and those sorts of things. But I do think my wiring is to think debt is, you know, should be avoided where possible.
Right. We will not find you at the horse races. All right. Fair enough. Leanne, thank you for joining us and thanks for your candor.
Oh, my pleasure.
Leanne Davey, author of The Good Fight. Use productive conflict to get your team and organization back on track. That is our program for today. You can subscribe to the show on any of your podcast platforms out there. Feel free to write us a review. If you're a social media butterfly, you can also connect with me on Twitter at Bruce Sellery, S-E-L-L-E-R-Y, Bruce Sellery, Moolala on Facebook. Thank you very much for joining us and have a great day.